America's Cannabis Conversation. Heard every Saturday at 4:20 p.m. online at americascannabisconversation.com. We're part of the W420 Radio Network, and each week we provide you with information, education, and insight into the exploding medical and recreational cannabis industry. You'll hear from industry leaders, elected officials, local experts, detractors, and more. Learn how to build your own cannabis business, how to grow the product, what's legal, and where it's legal. Tune in each week to hear updates from the National Cannabis Industry Association in Washington, tips on investing in cannabis markets, personal success stories, and more. It's now time to join America's Cannabis Conversation. Time now for another intriguing tale on the ever-fascinating cannabis trail with W420 Radio Network's lifestyle correspondent, Rich Wolkoff.
Well, cannabis fans, for the first time ever, the City of Angels this spring is going to host the Emerald Cup. Yeah, they're billing it as the Academy Awards of Cannabis, and we are privileged and honored to have the two founder and executive producers, that is Tim and Taylor Blake, on board here on America's Cannabis Conversation. So guys, after 17 years in Northern California, you headed south May 13th and 14th. That's when the Emerald Cup will be held at the Green Street Festival. What was the big decision behind the move, guys?
Well, we looked at what was happening after legalization in 2017, and we realized that the best place for our contestants and for our vendors and sponsors was to be at the, in the largest media market, the largest cannabis market in the world, which is LA by far. And so we just knew we had to go down that direction. And so we worked with the city of Long Beach, and we were one public meeting away from being approved to have the show down there in 2019 when COVID hit. So we really got backed up for a couple of years, but the intention has been to go to LA for a few years now. When we first moved out of the Emerald Triangle to Sonoma County in Santa Rosa, people thought we were abandoning the Emerald Triangle. But after the first year, when they realized how successful it was to interact with the vendors and make money and to win on the stages in Santa Rosa, everybody wanted to join us. And we had a waiting list for vendors and sponsors, and the contestants blew up. So it's a good thing for everybody involved, and we're really proud to be heading to LA.
Sure. Taylor, you want to chime in on your thoughts?
Yeah, no, we're super excited about partnering with Green Street Festival for the award show, because for us, this award show is going to be us coming back in person, because we haven't been in person at the award show since 2019. So we're just super excited to be back with our contestants and our winners.
Yeah. So instead of rolling out the red carpet like the Academy Awards, you're going to have the green carpet, right? You're going to have the figurative all going green. Now you got, this is the largest festival of its kind in the world. And tell us about, what's going on. What are the highlights?
Well, we've gone from one flowers contest that we started out with, where we have 43 contests now. So it's become quite a competition over the years that's come in. As far as the in public aspect of it, yeah, we're very excited to be working with Rama and the Green Street team to be doing a show downtown this year. It'll be limited to 7,000 people this year, with the thought that next year we'd have a much larger show. So we're very excited to see the contest roll from one flowers competition to 43 competitions. It's really been something. We've entered the flowers and divided up into terpenes, the same with the concentrates now. We've added on indoor over the last year. We've got best of show between the mixed light and the indoor and the sun grown. So it's really been a fun thing to watch the evolution of the competition, which is the heart and soul of the content of the show.
Sure. And you tell me about the judges. I think I met Nikki and I met Swami at the Harvest Ball, which is tied into the Emerald Cup up in Santa Rosa, Northern California, closer to the Emerald Triangle. And I also met Mighty Mickey 420, your good character. And what a character, man. He's the cannabis clown of all time, man. But he told me a little bit about the genesis, but I wanted, in your words, how did this all start some 18 years ago? The idea that you'd have a competition, obviously was friendly at the time, and now it may be a little more competitive, but the idea of competing to who can come up with the best, prettiest, sweetest, tastiest buds.
Going back for a second to Mighty Mickey, he was the clown with Ringling Brothers. He's hosted all these events, and he came to me one day and said, Tim, I'm going to morph from Mighty Mickey the Clown to Mighty Mickey, the ambassador of the Emerald Cup. And he showed up one day with this whole outfit, and he's just a perfect ambassador for the Emerald Cup and for cannabis in general. They get more pictures taken with him than anybody else. I just love Mickey. He's something else. He's 80 years old and he's still showing people how to rock it. As far as the event, you know, 18 years ago, we were sitting around and I grew up going to county fairs like most of us and seeing the competitions, the, you know, the animals, the, you know, they're just the wonderful aspect of it. And we thought, got to be nice if cannabis could be included like that. So we started with a very small contest at my event center at Area 101 in Laytonville. And it was a couple hundred people and a couple dozen entries. And boy, everybody thought we'd just get, be lucky if we didn't get busted. And over the years, it's evolved from that one simple contest and a couple hundred people to 30,000 people in 43 contests.
Oh, that's awesome. And of course, you had to do it under the radar. I mean, Mighty Mickey 420 was telling me you couldn't even identify whose buds it was for fear of retribution legally and such.
Oh, no. We the first and third place winners wouldn't even show up at the stage to get their awards that first year. There were a lot of people in mass. I mean, High Times didn't come in for another 7 or 8 years into this country. It was still very illegal at that time. And most people were really banking on us getting busted. So we were very thankful that we just pulled it off and we were able to move forward.
Isn't it crazy? The evolution. Here we are 18 years later, not only mainstream, but embraced by so many people and understood so much more. Tell me a little bit about that and how much that means to you as the guys who are the founders and creators of the Emerald Cup.
Well, I'm 65. I started dealing when I was 14. So I've been an outlaw and dealing, you know, for over 50 years. So I've watched every decade since the 70s, this unfold. I watched the beginning of indoor when it first came in. I watched the private prisons get built and the minimum mandatories when they put everybody in jail for 10, 15, 20 years. I watched the evolution of the large indoor operations all the way into 215, into the Emerald Cup in the early 2000s. I've watched every bit of it. And it is so satisfying to be able to see the evolution of it and to see how much it's been embraced and how much it's being, you know, accepted into society all over this country and all over the world. It's taking its rightful place as the largest agricultural crop in the world very quickly.
Yeah, that's awesome to hear. And your keynote speaker, Gary Vaynerchuk, I mean, he is entrepreneur extraordinaire. Tell me a little bit about what he's going to be saying and why you chose him as your keynote speaker.
Well, he's partners with Rama in the Green Street Festival. They've been partnering in the whole building down there. He's been a friend of the whole team down there for quite some time. And we're honored to be working with Gary. He's an inspirational speaker. He's a very successful business person. You learn more about him. And it's just he's a phenomenon all unto himself with his passionate, inspirational, positive message and vibe. So he's a natural to be the keynote speaker at the Green Street Festival. He's a natural to be partners with, and we're very privileged and honored to have him as part of our team.
Cool. Taylor, could you talk a little bit about how the handcrafted and boutique grow and growers and cultivators and such, the challenges they face now with corporatization and, you know, agribusiness coming in and swooping up small grows and kind of changing the whole matrix of things?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, coming as an event that's out of Northern California and being cultivators in our history ourselves, you know, it's like, I think that there's this plight of the small farmer that we really recognize and want to support at every aspect of the Emerald Cup show. Because as you think about it from just even a quality perspective, I mean, the tomatoes that you grow in your own garden or that you get at the farmer's market are leaps and bounds better than the tomatoes that you buy at like Safeway, no offense. But it's just that there's a quality perspective there that I think really resonates with people. And I think that the legacy element of cannabis farmers in Northern California is something that's so sacred. They're the shoulders on which the whole industry is standing on to be in the legal market. And so we need to make sure and preserve the fact that the small farmers still have a seat at the table. And so one of the things that we're doing this year, we had a small farm initiative that we did at the Harvest Ball. So what we did was there was an application process for farmers with an under 10,000 square foot cultivation space. And we allowed them to apply for a free booth space at the Harvest Bowl. And it was such a success. It was like everybody's favorite area of the Emerald Cup event because it just had so much heart and soul in it. And so it was really important for us to carry over that excitement and that, like, you know, just special connection into the contest. So we are also offering 10 of those applicants a free entry into this year's competition, as well as, you know, just encouraging everyone to use their purchasing power to support small farms.
Absolutely. I mean, you got to remember the legacy growers and those who do it, you know, literally by hand, the handcrafted boutique growers. It's awesome. This is America's Cannabis Conversation. Rich Walkoff with Tim and Taylor Blake, who are the executive producer and founder of the Emerald Cup. Now, you talked about the Harvest Bowl in Santa Rosa. In the last couple of years I was there, well, I guess this past December, what I saw, the biggest crowds for the seed, the people selling the seeds, it was crazy. You got to tell me why there's such an attraction and what the major appeal is over clones. Because, you know, if you get into the real nitty gritty of get into the weed of the weeds and the horticultural nature of it, you could tell us why it's so critical to go from seed to grow from seed.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have a lot stronger plant when you're growing from seed, so you can get control over that. You don't have the issues as much with the clones with a weaker root system, so you don't have the pests and some of the challenges with that. And, you know, there's just people that are doing some incredible genetics, and so people want to really follow those genetics and really get that. And the genetic companies have always done very good at our shows. People line up, they get VIP tickets just to get in early to deal with the latest genetics. And they come to the Harvest Bowl to get those genetics and to get the latest flowers and to meet with everybody. And it's really just the market that's just so fun for people to come into.
Yeah, I couldn't believe just a handful of seeds can cost a considerable amount of money. But of course, those handful of seeds can go a long way to creating a beautiful crop.
Yeah, well, yes. When Aficionado first won, back in, I think 2016, well, I'm not sure exactly what year it was. It was 2012. Boy, I'm dating myself, Taylor. Look at that. Gosh. So 2012, when Leo and Aficionado won, well, it went from like $5 to $10 a seed to where they were getting $50 a seed. And they had them in really beautiful packaging, little boxes and whatnot. And I got one of the old boxes, and they're a little dated now. They don't look nearly as good as what we have now. But back then, it was revolutionary. So they were selling them by the box load. And it really made people realize where the genetics were going to go and how it was going to evolve. And, you know, over the years, Mean Gene with Jackson and all the genetic people have just done very well at our show.
That's awesome. And that's so incredible. You got to tell me, who are the judges? How does this go down? I mean, you guys sit in a corner and sample with no labels, so you get kind of like a blind taste test, or how does it unfold?
Well, I can just jump in and say it's very interesting because everyone's always like wants to be a judge, and they've always asked us. And so we actually we decided to start taking applications to become a judge. So anybody can apply and become a judge. And we have many stories each year, the past 3 years, of people that have just applied that we've never met that we've allowed to become a judge on just doing a little bit of research and making sure that they can hang in the judging process, because it's something that is so funny because people are like, oh my gosh, that must be super fun to be a judge. And in so many ways it is, but you have to have a very strong tolerance in whatever category it is that you are judging, because it is definitely like an expert level of a palate that you must sort of have. Because I mean, especially for our flower judges, I mean, they're getting anywhere from 300 to 500 to, you know, in the past it used to be up to 700, 800 entries that they have to go through and sample and try. And so to not only try them, but also give great feedback and point scores on every single entry takes a level of connoisseur that we are very, very honored to have on our judging panel this year. We have over almost 100 judges from all over the state, from all the way up in Humboldt to San Diego to Nevada City to a lot of representation in the Emerald Triangle. So we definitely are super excited about our judges.
Yeah, you better know what you're doing. It's not like the wine case. You spit it out and try again, and you just put it on your. You've got to ingest it in some way, shape, or form, and you better have some tolerance and better know what you're doing. Yeah. Do we have any celebrity judges, per se?
Well, we have a few celebrity judges that we're just about to get in the ability to announce. So stay tuned for that. But we do have some can of celebrity judges of quite a good variety. We have like the Dank Duchess. We have Bobby Black. We have Jason Pinsky. We have Nikki and Swami, who you met. We have Maya from Om Edibles as a Sullivan List judge. We have a lot of very well-respected people in the industry as judges, and we're super honored to have them.
You have some new categories like most innovative product and a terpene kind of evaluation. So talk a little bit about that.
Do you want to go in for that, Tim? Or do you want me to take it?
Go ahead.
Well, innovative product is definitely one of our most fun categories to judge, because in the realm of innovation, that's why we split it up into two different categories this year. One's consumable and one is not, because there's so much innovation always happening in cannabis. And it's really exciting to see. And so we started that category 3 years ago to do most innovative product. It can be either consumable or not. So we have the two separate categories. And last year we actually had this seed puck win. So it was like cannabis seeds in like a little puck that all you have to do is like put it into water. And it has like all the nutrients and like little growing medium in it, into which it will just sprout just based out of the little puck. So it's kind of like a one-stop shop for seed sprouting, which is why it won, because we had never seen anything like that before. And for the terpene categorization, it's actually really cool and very cutting edge in the way of terpene science. We are doing a terpene test for all flower, solventless, and hydrocarbon entries that we receive. And that terpene test will then delineate which of us seven terpene categories that those entries would then align with. And then that's how the judges will receive their product. They'll be sorted by its terpene structure. So it will be like a, you know, in sort of similarness of strains, it'll be like gases going against gases, fruit strains going against fruit strains. You know, instead of getting into the paradigm of sativa versus indica, which is outdated at this point.
I love that. That's cool. And I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about Harry Mack, the freestyle rapper, who I, to be honest, I hadn't heard, but I checked him out and the guy is off the hook. I mean, what kind of crazy skill set he's got. And when is he going to be doing his thing at your Emerald Cup this spring in L.A.?
Harry Mack is actually doing a really cool fireside chat with Gary Vee on the Friday night. So the Friday night is a dinner, more like seated event, the Friday night of the 13th. And then the Saturday, the 14th, is the festival that's going to be outside with Juicy J performing, and Harry Mack will be there. One thing you may not know is actually Tim is a very famous freestyle rapper himself. I'm sure he could, if you drop a beat, he could just jump right into it right now.
Love it. Tim, you may be on the spot now, you need some herbal inducements to bust it out. I don't know. You tell me.
No, she's making fun of me. I'm more of a dancer than a freestyler. I actually had a rap label at one time called Lethal Beat Records back in the 80s. So my claim on that one was with Bootsy Collins back in the day. So I go back quite a bit in the production world with that. But yeah, we're going to have quite a few fun things to do. We are going to have some celebrity judges that we are going to announcing. Be Real from Cypress Hill judged for us last year, and I think he's going to be back. And we've got a couple other very special announcements as to who's going to join us. So that's going to be fun.
Hey, I can't wait. It's going to be awesome. Tell us how we can get tickets, learn more. Emerald Cup, May 13, 14 in Los Angeles.
Yeah, so tickets are available on greenstreetfestival.com. And you can also find out more information about how to enter our competition on our website, which is theemeraldcup.com. And also, you can follow us on all of our social channels, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and get more information.
Well, fabulous. Congratulations. You guys are still rocking it. 18th year going to L.A. May it be a great rookie season for you down there. Awesome stuff. Tim and Taylor Blake, founder and executive producer of the Emerald Cup. You guys have a blast. Appreciate you coming on our show.
It's a pleasure. Well, anytime. You're more than welcome to be our guest at any show we come to.
That's great. Yeah. The America's Cannabis Conversation. I'm Rich Walkoff on the W420 Radio Network. Stick around.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on W420RadioNetwork.com. Are you interested in learning more about cannabis? Have you thought about starting your own cannabis business but don't know how? If so, we invite you to join the Cannabis Conversation with other people like you who are looking at the exciting opportunities in this exploding business. Listen to America's Cannabis Conversation. You'll hear from industry experts and get insights into the cannabis industry. For archived shows and for more information, log on to americascannabisconversation.com. It's time for Women in Cannabis on America's Cannabis Conversation, part of the W420 Radio Network.
Didn't you get the memo?
Here's Chase Roberts.
Welcome back to the conversation. This is Chase Roberts, Women in Cannabis correspondent for the W420 Radio Network. It's a pleasure to introduce Christina De Giovanni, CEO of The Emerald, and she is also an award-winning journalist. Christina, welcome. Thanks for being here. How are you?
Thank you so much. I'm doing very well, and I'm very excited to be a guest today. How are you doing?
I am great. Thank you so much. All things considered. And yes, here at W420, we're glad we are having you on the airwaves. Christina, let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up?
I was born in San Diego, California, and lived there until I was about 9 or 10. And then I went over to Austin, Texas. From there, I got caught smoking cannabis when I was a freshman in high school. So my parents basically said, you know what? I think boarding school might be a good option. Oh.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I'll never forget the first time my mom caught me smoking cannabis. I had a neighbor boy over who I was smoking with, and he hid under my bed the whole time while she cried and she yelled and she screamed, and poor guy. So then after that, you know, I didn't stop smoking cannabis, and my parents would raid my room religiously. And I, you know, there was no trust and no cell phone and all of that drama that comes in with it. So eventually I was actually really excited to go to boarding school. I was like, fantastic. I get to get away from my parents.
Yeah.
I get to be this young adult that I've always wanted to be. And so I went to an all girls boarding school in New Jersey, and I did smoke cannabis a couple times there, not a lot. It's a very small campus and lots of tattletalers. So I was able to get away with it a few times. I took an apple from the dining hall, stepped into the basement a couple nights, went out to the soccer field for a few walks occasionally.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, from there, when I was in my junior year of high school, you know, you start researching colleges where you want to go. And I actually typed into Google, because I had dreadlocks at the time. I was this very, you know, bohemian flower child, you know, living this like cannabis lifestyle at an early age. And I went to Google and I just typed in hippie colleges.
That's funny. That's really funny. And genius, I might add.
Yeah. And, you know, fortunately, High Times magazine had actually done an article right on this subject. And it was the top 10 most liberal colleges in America. And Humboldt State was number one.
Yeah. You received a Bachelor's of Arts in Journalism and Education from Humboldt State. And you did a lot of reporting while you were there. You've also done radio and TV work, including you had apprenticeships at NPR and PBS affiliates here in California. Can you share some of the details of that experience and how that would go on to maybe inspire the path that you've been on?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, growing up, I loved Dateline, 2020, all those news shows that talk about true crimes. And so I always wanted to be Diane Sawyer when I was growing up. She's my idol.
Me too.
Just love Diane.
And I do too. She's my favorite.
Yeah. And so I went to Humboldt State for nursing. I wanted to be a psychiatric nurse. But due to budget cuts, they got rid of the program at Humboldt State. I think they since then have brought it back. But at the time, I wasn't even through my undergrad yet. So I said, you know what? I'm really good at public speaking. Let me switch to broadcast journalism because that's my dream job. And so, like you mentioned, you know, I had internships with affiliate station for NPR, for PBS, and it was great. I mean, being on camera, being behind the camera, you know, recording audio, editing it, all those creative endeavors I really enjoyed. And then in my last semester of college, I was dating a cultivator up in Humboldt County and we lived together, and he had actually got caught on an Amtrak train with bulk currency. So he had a lot of money on a train and he was basically profiled. The Reno Drug Task Force steps on in Reno right before the train enters California, because then they legally can seize what they find for the state of Nevada.
Were they tipped off for some reason? How would they know that was there? And what did they consider bulk back in the day, if you don't mind?
Yeah, I mean, so the law enforcement told me anything over $500 is considered suspicious. You know, wow. Why would the average person have more than $500 on them instead of having it in a bank? That's their mentality. But it's actually a routine search and seizure. Wow. They're known for doing this. We were not the first, and we certainly weren't the last. I remember telling someone in Humboldt County, you know, my boyfriend got profiled. I mean, they looked at him. They said, you know, he looked like a lumberjack, big beard, flannel shirt, like fit the bill for a cultivator. They looked at his driver's license. They saw his address in Arcata. They knew Humboldt County. They knew his
name.
You know, and it's funny because he took the train out of the state and he said the whole thing smelled like weed. You know, they don't care if you're leaving with it. They just want to catch you coming back with something. And so it's routine. It's routine search and seizure. They go to every person on the train. They go to all the sleeper cars. You know, like I said, they're on a mission. They got to meet their quota. Without a warrant, they illegally searched his luggage. They found currency in there. They took it. They took his cell phone. They took everything out of his wallet. Again, all without a warrant. So this is illegal. And they called law enforcement in Humboldt County and they said, you know, go to this address. You know, we just apprehended this. Or they didn't even apprehend him. They never even arrested him. They just took his stuff and then left.
Did they read his Miranda rights or anything?
He was not arrested. So there was no need for the Miranda rights. But they did tell him, they threatened him. They said, if you file for this money, we will bring criminal charges against you. So they tried to intimidate him. They lied to him. I mean, essentially, like, he felt that his money was legal and valid. And so he filed for his money. And that's his right. And he fought for almost a year to get that money back. He eventually did get, unfortunately, only about $3,000 back, I think it was, at the end. So kind of a slap in the face after everything he had gone through. But they never brought criminal charges against him because it's not illegal to have money. So and he wasn't caught with any contraband. He had no drugs, no cannabis, no nothing like that. You know, and so that's, but it's called the poisonous apple effect, where there's an incident over here on the left and the apple runs down the tree. It runs down the ground and it leads over here on the right. And on the right was me in our house. So yes. I had this very abrasive pounding at the front door at like 9 a.m. And I jump out of bed because I'm like, this is not normal. And the whole Humboldt County Drug Task Force was in my front yard.
Terrifying.
Guns drawn, bulletproof vests on. It was like a scene out of a movie. So I, you know, I was like, what are you doing here? How can I help you? And they said, you know, this person was caught with this. And then without even missing a beat, the cop was like, I smell fresh growing cannabis in there and I need to enter. And I was like, that's ridiculous. We're not growing any weed here. And my landlords actually lived in the house next door. And my landlord was there and he was like, no, no, no. I do a walkthrough every month. They're not growing cannabis. I was just in there the other day. The cops didn't care. They're supposed to check the meters outside of your house to see if your electrical usage is, you know, out of range.
Right. Yeah. It would be really high. Yeah.
Yeah. But they did not do that because they didn't care. And so they entered my home illegally without a warrant. They searched the entire home without a warrant. They saw that we were not cultivating cannabis. So their excuse to come in was invalid. And then they, you know, we had cannabis at the house, but we both were medical patients. So the amount that we had was acceptable under the Proposition 215.
Did you fight this? Did you get any civil justice for this?
So I went to jail. I was arrested. And fortunately, you know, I was able to get bailed out. So I wasn't in there overnight. And I know that there's a lot of people that are arrested for cannabis that lose their lives to this. And, you know, as I was sitting in jail with no shoes on, with cold feet, because they take your dignity away from you, you have to go to the bathroom in front of everybody else. So I basically held it for like 10 hours. I was like, there's no way I'm going to go to the bathroom in front of like a ton of strangers here. So when they, you know, take your dignity away from you, your wheels start turning. And I basically said, you know, the pen is mightier than the sword. You know, I'm earning my degree in journalism in my last semester of college. I'm going to create what started off as a revenge magazine to tell the truth about bad cops. Because when I, you know, fast forward a couple of days, when I received my forfeiture papers from the district attorney, there was about $10,000 that went missing from what was seized in my house. So I kind of skipped that part. So eventually, after about 5 or 6 hours, a judge did sign a warrant. The only place they had left to look was the attic, where we did have more currency in the attic. So based on that currency, I was arrested. And there was also a few other charges. One of them was like pitiful. I had like a paper bag, like a grocery bag full of old trim that I should have just thrown out because it was so aged, but I, you know, just
kept it
because one day I could make edibles, who knows? And I had it in a spare bedroom and they considered that harboring a room for drug manufacturing. So that was also another charge that they tried to slap me with. So long story short, went to jail, was bailed out, created this idea while I was sitting there to, you know, create a publication. And when the district attorney served me my forfeiture papers, there's about $10,000 missing from what was in the attic. And there was only about 10 officers there. So I absolutely believe that they each pocketed a grand. And, you know, fast forward down the road, the sheriff of Humboldt County was on the NPR radio station. Or he was on KMUD, which is like another nonprofit radio station up there. And I called in and I told him everything I just said.
That's amazing. Did you really? Okay. Yeah. Christina, that takes some real, real bravery. So you called in and you put him on the spot. And what was his response?
Well, he said, I would like you to come down to the station tomorrow and we could talk about this. And I literally responded back to him. And I recorded this. I have it somewhere on my computer. I said, I was like, who do I tell the cops on? The cops? Like, who is supposed to be people when law enforcement commits a crime? Where do I go? Where does the people go to get law enforcement in trouble? How do we hold them accountable for their criminal activity?
Valid question.
And he couldn't answer that. And the radio host was like, well, if there's any police corruption, I'm sure the sheriff would like to know about it. And I said, who do I tell the cops on? The cops? Like, this is ridiculous. Right. You know, so I never went in. I mean, I made my point on that call, but, you know, I mean, that really, all of that, I channeled all of that anger, that resentment, that rage that had accumulated from being apprehended. And I said, you know what, the pen is mightier than the sword. Let's just start a media outlet. So we have the microphone, because unfortunately all the news outlets in Humboldt County, you know, I was always raised to believe innocent until proven guilty, but apparently, you know, even for my own kind, my own journalists, my own, you know, people, I guess, you know, they put your mugshot out there. They make you look guilty before you've had a chance to prove your innocence.
And so many people, this happens to so many people. And, you know, later I am going to ask you about one of the projects you guys work on that really addresses this, but this whole experience of the arrest, going to jail, what happened to your friend was really the impetus for you to start Emerald, as you said. And it started as Northern California Magazine, but really over the last 10 years, it's morphed into such a great, amazing media outlet. Can you, for our listeners who don't know, which I would find shocking, can you tell a little more about your outlet and what it provides now?
Absolutely. I mean, so we're a cannabis news and culture magazine. So we do have a print magazine, but we're also very active online. You know, we do articles every day. We do podcasts. We do news. We send a newsletter out 3 times a week. And we're all about, we've got 4 main pillars of the company: culture, sustainability, social equity, and normalization. So, you know, I mean, sustainability. We know that cannabis has a packaging problem. If anyone's been in a regulated state, it's a package inside of a package inside of a package, and then you throw it away at the end. So it's, you know, we are committed to sustainability. We're committed to social equity and culture. We know that there's over 40,000 people still in prison for cannabis-related arrests, and that's not right. I mean, it's just not right that these people are profiting out here while others are sitting in jail rotting away.
It's a huge injustice. It makes no sense. I know the Last Prisoner Project is one of the groups, you know, Emerald Media supports. And yeah, as you mentioned, there's over 40,000 cannabis prisoners today, in just the US alone, that are in prison worldwide, convicted of activity that's no longer a crime.
Right. It's shameful. And it's our job as the media to shine light on that. You know, the power of the pen, the power of our words, the power of social media, it can change lives. Even the power of the iPhone has made documentaries that have, you know, helped exonerate people or, you know, bring justice to a situation. I mean, the way in which our world works now, the way in which media works now is really incredible, because we're able to make change with just the click of a button, essentially. And so, you know, and having been to jail for cannabis, you realize how ridiculous it is, you know. And I remember when the election was going on in California and legalization was on the ballot, we used to have people call our office and say, you know, what do you recommend? What do you think? And of course, I never would tell anyone how to vote. That's incredibly personal. And I don't want to know how you're voting. But I would say to them, have you ever been arrested for weed? And some of them would be like, yes. And some would be like, no. And for the ones that said yes, I'd say, didn't you think that was ridiculous?
Well, you know, and all those records need to be expunged.
Right. Or use your arrest record to your advantage and get a license and fight the man that way. You know, the best revenge is living well. So, you know, if you've been arrested for cannabis and you have a record, you know, either try to get it expunged if that means something to you, or use it to your advantage. Try to get a license, you know, try to take advantage of a terrible situation. And so, you know, I mean, the Emerald is the brainchild of a terrible situation. The Emerald was my therapy in getting over my arrest, because I absolutely had PTSD following that arrest. You know, I was apprehended by 10 armed cops, you know, when I was just a 21 or a 23-year-old in college, like, you know, planning to go to class that day.
That absolutely sounds traumatic.
Yeah. I mean, it was a crazy experience. But I mean, over the last 10 years, people have been very appreciative and very receptive to the direction and the mission that we have, because we're not about grungy stoner stereotypes, boobs, blunts, bongs. Like, no, like, and don't get me wrong. Like, I love blunts and bongs. and boobs are great, but it's like, that's not who we are. We are a modern day media outlet that not only chronicles what the industry looks like, but we're normalizing the cannabis industry for outsiders that might be reserved or hesitant to try cannabis, to try CBD, to dabble in the industry. We're here to show you, you know, what products are on the market. We're here to show you like the latest news and legislation. We're here to introduce you to all these amazing entrepreneurs and gondrepreneurs in the cannabis industry and really just help normalize it and break down these stereotypes. And so I believe because of our mission over the last 10 years, that's why Emerald has been successful. That's why we've stayed afloat, is because we really do bring a fresh perspective on what the cannabis industry is today.
Absolutely. Off the top of your head, are there any stories you can think of over the last 10 years that Emerald has covered that have either resonated with you or had a really huge impact to you personally You guys have covered so many great things, mm-hmm. big stories.
Yeah, I mean, this one isn't necessarily a story, more of a list. So we launched something in 2020 called the Conscious Consumption Series. And it's all about highlighting these minority-founded businesses in the cannabis industry to give back support for people, again, that have been marginalized or have been victims of the war on drugs. So we launched in 2020 the first list, which was 100 plus Black-founded cannabis businesses to support right now. And that was, it took off beyond our belief. You know, I mean, we just put it out there because we wanted to list 100 businesses. You know, we felt 100 was the minimum that we could do. And it just, it went viral on social media. And I don't know the latest count on those businesses, but we're adding businesses every single day to that list.
Good.
And so we have 100 plus Black founded, Indigenous founded, Latinx founded, Asian founded, and LGBTQ founded. And the next one we're working on is the women founded list. So if there's any women out there that are listening to this that want to be added to the list, you know, please send us an email and we'll get you on that list. But, yes. You know, it's important to highlight these companies that have to struggle a little bit more than their, you know,
absolutely
counterparts.
We just did a interview with someone from MJ Biz Daily, and they came out with a white paper about women and minorities in cannabis. I don't even like that word, but basically it came out that as it expands and more women are getting involved, in actuality, the percentage of executive positions held by women declined in 2021 after a spike in 2019. And I was like, what the heck is going on here? So the fight for women in this industry, for minorities and, you know, underrepresented people is very, it's a huge, huge concern. Are there direct links for people to go look at these lists on your website? Are they housed somewhere special?
Yeah. So, right. If you log on to our website, theemeraldmagazine.com, you'll see a couple hyperlinks right on the homepage. And I think the first one says like either it says either conscious consumption or it says 100 plus minority businesses to support right now. And so that will lead you, that link will click over to all the lists. So if you're an Indigenous founded business, if you're a, you know, a Pacific Islander founded business, an Asian business, an LGBTQ founded business, you know, just send us an email, info@theemeraldmagazine.com, and we'll get you on there. There's a couple questions, you know, we need to vet some of these companies just to make sure that, you know, it's everyone should be an ally, but, you know, allies don't belong on the Black founded list, unless if you are Black. I mean, we want to
absolutely, it needs to be vetted for sure.
We want to make sure that everyone on there, you know, has fair and equal representation. And so, and it's straight across the board, but, you know, I mean, we really, we've had a couple companies reach out to us that are not directly in the cannabis industry. And so, we have an editor that really manages those lists and oversees them. So,
you know, fantastic.
Yeah.
So our listeners, you know, please take advantage of those lists. Christina, unfortunately, our time is up. I really want to thank you for being here. You're welcome back anytime. If you miss any of this great interview with Christina De Giovanni, you can go to W420 Radio Network and click on the archive section to listen to this and other great interviews. And we'll be right back.
America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing team. America's Cannabis Conversation offers listeners insight and information on the exploding world of cannabis. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach a hyper-targeted audience, literally neighborhood by neighborhood, in markets all across the country. We're looking for a few motivated individuals that want to essentially run their own local business. To learn more about this exciting opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com.
Well, today we've got a fascinating and uplifting tale of a young man who had a transformative experience in his life at the age of 18 after a troubled early years in childhood. Joined the Army, went to Iraq, going to fight for the U.S. of A., and unfortunately had a very tragic near you know, almost killed in Iraq, but that itself really changed the course of your life. So welcome in Cody Walker, a longtime cultivator, dispensary owner, and he's got experience running high-end extraction labs in the Bay Area of San Francisco. And Cody, before we get into the cannabis world, tell me about the absolutely gut-wrenching experience that you had as an 18-year-old near Baghdad a number of years ago. That was, you know, it was a terrible experience, but it really changed the course of your life.
Yeah. So back in 2004, I was shipped off to Iraq as a young 18-year-old soldier, just fresh off boot camp. Actually, about a month and a half after boot camp, I was shipped out to Iraq. One morning, I was actually on top of a turret, and we were headed out on a mission, and somebody blew up what they call a VBIED. It's a vehicle-borne improvised explosive device. So basically, they turned their truck into a big bomb. I took some shrapnel. It's severed my nose off my face completely, sort of cut my lips from here to here and filleted them off my face. I got shot in the cheek and out my mouth. And then I got shot once in my shoulder, sort of all in the same instance. Yeah.
That is amazing. You survived the bombing and then the friendly fire from the patrol officer. Just expound upon that a little bit, because this is something I've never heard. You should have been dead a long time ago, brother, but here you are in front of a beautiful plant. Yep. That was also instrumental in helping you recover from the PTSD.
Yeah. So I did take a little bit of friendly fire. You know, it does happen. You can't be mad at anybody for it. But I was shot with a 9mm from my commander through my cheek, and he was trying to sort of fire over my truck. And I stood up, got in the way. And, you know, back in the day, I used to watch magicians catch bullets with their teeth. And I am here to tell you that that's not true. That's a lie. They cannot catch them with their teeth. Yeah. I got mine shot out trying to do it. So,
yeah,
it was a very interesting day. You know, real early in the morning, we were so close to my forward operating base that the turret guys on the post was actually, you know, they were engaged in the firefight also. So realistically, if I would have been, you know, 10 miles out of the base, I don't know if I'd be here today. There's not a lot of people that get shot in their face and get to talk about it later on and get to do what we get to do here. And, you know, it was very, very instrumental in sort of the way that I've been raised and the way that I live my life now. It's, you know, a very disciplined life at this point. And we're really, really proud of what we've been able to accomplish.
Yeah. Well, tell me, you're medevaced out, you come home, the government gives you some money. And what do you do with it? And how did it change the course of your life in a favorable way as you dealt with the physical, emotional, and psychological scars from that horrible day?
Yeah. So as an 18-year-old boy, I was what they call a Cav Scout. I did reconnaissance for the infantry, for the cavalry, for, you know, tank battalion, stuff like that. If they wanted to know what was on the other side of that hill, I went and told them. Now, in civilian life, there's not a lot that I can do with that. So I didn't leave the military with a grand job that I could go and be, you know, in telecommunications or something like that. I was a recon scout. There's not a lot of people that need, you know, that service outside of the military. So I was very fortunate. I got a large lump of sum of money after I got out of the military due to a government program that I sort of tried out for. I was broke. I didn't have a penny to my name. I was actually in McDonald's one morning. And this program, basically, you fill out paperwork, they send you cash, or they send you, you know, money into your bank account a couple of months later. You never know if it's going to come or when it's going to come. So I was sitting in McDonald's and I was looking at the dollar menu, and my wife calls me up and she says, "Honey, we have $50,000 in the bank account." I was like, "Okay, I'll take a number 6 instead of a dollar menu item." You know, I was able to reach for the stars in that one. And, you know, so right then and there, I turned around, talked to my wife, said, "Listen, cannabis has been a huge part of my life ever since I was a kid. I'm sort of a second generation guy, thanks to my dad. He grew up and taught us this great plant, and to have the respect for the plant that we do. And so I said, "Hun, let's open up a grow. Let's do this. You know, let's go buy some lights. Let's go rent some space." So I moved her out of Southern California, and we moved up to Oregon, and we sort of started our first large, you know, cannabis business after trying to sort of poke around and play around for a little bit. So we started our grow operation on the government's dime, thank goodness. And here we are today.
Yeah, kind of ironic that other veterans who go to the VA with PTSD or trauma in any way, shape, or form are not able to receive cannabis as a medical treatment for their mental, psychological, and other injuries and the like. Yet here you are, launched a career in it. Just tell me what role it played in your recovery and how it to this day is instrumental in keeping you on track. Because a lot of people think, yeah, great, get high, weed's a great party drug. Well, there's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, especially with the new legalization, it's really referred to a lot of the time as recreational cannabis. And I try to sort of steer people away from that because it's adult use cannabis at this point. Yes, we can have fun with it. I do enjoy getting high myself, but I use it as a medicine, and I use it as a tool in my tool belt to really get over the anxiety, to help me sleep. I utilize CBD a lot to sort of keep my body in line. I really push for the anti-anxiety properties, especially with veterans. We deal with a lot of PTSD, sleep issues, and just general mental health issues. It's a very, very rough life, especially for somebody who's seen combat. So, you know, we really push it onto our veterans. And there's a couple of different programs that we work through to try to get veterans safe access to cannabis. Because you're right, the government won't allow us to do it yet. And as sad as it is, and as much research as there is behind it, you know, I really wish we could push it a little bit further. But right now, you know, we're doing what we can. And I really enjoy watching the progression of how cannabis changes the lives of veterans. In particular, and it's primarily along the depression side. Also, you know, it's PTSD is a tough one to battle because there's so many different problems that happen with it. And if you can start to get some of those aligned into a good alignment, you're sleeping better, which means you're eating better, which means you're happier, which means you're not as depressed. You know, the little things start to come in and roll up and really change veterans' lives. And so I work with personal friends. We work, like I said, with a couple of different companies to try to get some safe access for medicine, because at this point it is medicine.
Absolutely. And you're giving back, and that's awesome. And speaking of back, right back behind you is a beautiful garden. And you got to tell us where you're at and what it's all about.
Yeah, so we've got two indoor cultivation sites here. Both rooms are about 110 lights, and we've got about 420 plants in each room. We cycle through them every 8.5 to 9 weeks, and we grow about 300 to 350 pounds per room. This is utilized in both, you know, our brands, our personal brands, and then we also help some brands, you know, further themselves also. So we've got Low Key, we've got Dosha, and we've got Bay Ride as our three brands. And shameless plug here, but you know, I got to be honest, it's some of the finer medication that I've been able to produce. There's 100,000 different CBD companies, and what I always suggest is go to your friends and your family and see who's using it, see why they're using it, and do some self research about the companies that you're getting yourself into, because not all companies are created equal. And you know, some of the big corporation companies, they're, you know, just as they're just as bad as some of the little companies, you know. Yeah. And so really trying to do some self-research now, trying to find a company is difficult because it's an unregulated market. There's not a like a process to go through in order to become a CBD company. You can do it in your backyard if you really wanted to. So I would suggest, you know, looking into the company more than looking into the product. Most companies use what we call CBD isolate, which is a 99.99% isolated form of the CBD molecule. And so the molecule is not going to change. It's like using bleach. It's bleach is bleach, right? So CBD is normally CBD, but getting the right company that utilizes it with the right terpenes, the right additives, is really where you want to go. So I always trust my friends and my family that have tried it before. And then there's always just calling and asking questions, it's a lot of self-research right now. If you really want to start getting into CBD, which is sad, but there is a lot of education about it out and about right now.
Yeah. Got to do your research and find some friends who have had good experiences. Another, product that is blowing up, but now is becoming very contentious, is Delta 8 THC, which has been banned now in 15 states. The good news, Connecticut became the 19th state to legalize adult marijuana use. Great. But almost as many states are now banning Delta 8 THC, which, as I understand, is, it's an anomaly. But you tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So cannabis goes through what we call isomerizations. And that means that it can change its form depending on what the chemical makeup of it is. And what we're doing is we're converting CBD, which is a mass form, we can produce a lot of it, and we're converting it using a couple of different methods, but usually a high acid method, in order to essentially convert the CBD into Delta 8 THC. It doesn't have as much of the psychoactive effects to it, but the process is unregulated right now. And so that's really why the bans are coming out right now, is because if you don't do this process correctly, you're leaving products like lye or citric acid inside of these cartridges that can be very, very dangerous to the consumer. So until there's a set regulation and a set testing value to it, they're going to start banning it. And it's for consumer safety, because people do take shortcuts in labs to try to make money. And as sad as it is, it hurts people. And this big craze, because it doesn't go psychoactive, it can be sold in 7-Elevens and stuff like that, right along next to your CBD does. But the process is much more dangerous and rigorous than just doing it in your backyard. You really need to have a chemist on site, somebody who understands isomerization, somebody who understands the science behind it, before you start getting into non-tested Delta 8. And so I always caution people on the Delta 8 craze right now. If you find it in 7-Eleven, I would pretty much stay away from it. I personally, unless I know the manufacturer personally, I can't trust anything that's on the market right now, because the testing regulations aren't there. Cannabis, it has to be tested multiple times before it gets onto the shelf. And it's being tested for everything. Now, Delta 8 and CBD doesn't have to be tested. It's an industry norm to get it tested, but it doesn't have to be. And people can lie about their tests. They can test one thing and then send something else out to the market. And so Delta 8, it's an absolute great compound for different ailments. It just needs to be derived properly in order to effectively help a patient.
Yeah, so I guess you'd get it from a dispensary that is going through the rigorous screening process and testing process in whatever state you are. Would be the way to go. Hey, Cody, it was great catching up with you. Again, I want to just grab what's behind you and just run with it, baby. That's awesome. That's beautiful crop you've got there, and it's an amazing story. I mean, you almost gave your life in the service, and you got a second opportunity, and I'm glad you're giving back and using the cannabis in a healthy, positive way for many veterans as well. So really appreciate your time, and best of luck to you. Cody Walker, he's the whiz. He's the lab director at Bayride and a beautiful cannabis brand, Loki and Dosha, in Oakland, California.
Thank you for taking part in America's Cannabis Conversation. To hear this show in its entirety or to hear any of our archive shows, log on to americascannabisconversation.com and tune in for the next installment of America's Cannabis Conversation. W420RadioNetwork.com